Hello and welcome to The Dive presented by Honda. This is season 4, episode 43. We are taking a quick break from Shadowlands and the off season to answer some of your questions this week, as well as, you know, we got to touch on first off the bat, Double Lift. It seems funny. Yes, we're starting with a bunch of TSM stuff, but they're the ones that still have an extended off season that's bringing more drama. We have another basically North American Hall of Famer retiring here, and now a bigger salary pickup. They're just like one-upping each other as the teams go further and further with the Sword Art signing.
Yeah, I want to start just by talking about Double Lift. This is, you know, we talked a lot about Bjergsen when he retired. Now Double Lift's retiring in the same offseason. You know, that is the two most popular players, the two most iconic players in LCS history, both retiring in the same offseason. When you talk about the greatest players of all time in the LCS, these are the two guys that pretty much everyone is going to debate who's the best. And they're both gone, right? And that is kind of crazy to me to have that happen, you know, one after the other, especially, you know, Bjergsen retired and the Double Lift came out and said, you know, on Twitter that he was thinking about retiring, but he decided he didn't want to. And so now that it's happened later on, it's pretty surprising. And I just have, you know, so many good memories of Double Lift, you know, playing and competing in North America. Like, this guy has been synonymous with success in the region for so long. You know, won, I think it's 8 of the last 11 splits, and that's including, I think, where he took off a split across, you know, multiple different teams. Pretty much just wherever he went, he won the title. So it's pretty crazy to see him gone. And it's going to take a while to get used to.
Yeah, and I mean, the success that he's had, I mean, if you've only started, it sounds weird to say, if you've only started watching in the last 5 years, Double Lift is synonymous with success, but that's only half of league's history. If you go back to the first 5 years, there was a meme called Double Lift's trophy case. It was a subreddit and it was empty. And that was the whole joke, because for a period of time, everyone recognized his talent, but it wasn't clicking on his teams. There were supposed, you know, clashes and OG CLG was a bit of a mess with, you know, all the personalities in there and Hotshot and Saint Vicious and all this stuff. But for a long period of time, Double Lift was synonymous with CLG and they weren't able to win. And it was this really crazy arc to get to his first win in Madison Square Garden, which I still think is the greatest North American League event we've ever had, was that 2015 summer finals. And that's when his career, you know, took off, and he was been basically unbeatable since then. And it's crazy to think that there are these two really, really discrete chunks to his career. And so when you look back at all the memories, it's like he had to work so hard to get the W's in the second half.
Yeah, this one is so big to me, because Double Lift did play longer and was in the North American scene longer than Bjergsen. You know, Bjergsen came over as this super young kid, and right off the bat, you know, was killing it with TSM. But Double Lift's story has so much more depth to it, you know, because he did start almost as early as I started. Like, I am like the biggest boomer for LCS and for North American League, you know. But Double Lift was on Epic Gamer at the very beginning, and his whole story started with a Reddit post where he was kicked out of his family's house and was homeless. And Travis, my roommate, picked up Double Lift to let him sleep on his couch. And he started finding this success. You know, Epic Gamer, that team, this is before LCS even existed, went to the championship in season one and got fourth place. Yes, then we get into all the weeds about, you know, season one, blah, 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 what matters, how many teams are there, what regions and stuff. But we're talking about the history of this region. He was there before the LCS even existed, at the very beginning of professional North American League of Legends. Mm-hmm. He was there with the CLG that went over to Korea, you know, one of the most hotly debated, like, biggest, you know, blunders of, like, leaving the fan base in North America, going to Korea for competition, and placing in Champions League. He actually played and placed in Champions League over there in 2012. And then when the LCS started, like Mark is saying, going through the history of this guy. It was always an underdog history because his story started with the family troubles and being homeless and being on CLG and trying to fight as CLG against the godlike TSM who had taken over. And this was when TSM just ruled North America. They won everything, swept everything. And it was always like Doublelift is this underdog on CLG trying to fight against TSM for so long. And then it culminated in the 2015 Madison Square Garden, TSM versus CLG match Mark is talking about, which I agree is this, to me, is still just the most epic moment.
Yeah.
This Madison Square Garden, completely packed with fans, all cheering. It's going to make me cry because we're in COVID and we don't have, stadiums or fans.
We don't
or
have
champions.
Fun anymore.
It's emotional.
Exactly. And I'm just like, Doublelift's retiring. And we got COVID. And we're losing everything, guys. But, that Madison Square Garden. And then this is just when he first starts dropping bombs. You remember back to then, Mark, where you're like, oh my God, CLG took over. Are they going to now be the next TSM and start a dynasty? Nope. Doublelift is leaving CLG. And it was just like, your head just explodes. Doublelift left CLG for TSM. This is crazy drama. Oh my goodness. And then you get into the era Azale's talking about where he's dominating on TSM, and then they just picks up from there. And then he leaves TSM for Team Liquid. It's like, oh my God, the bombs just keep coming. And then he also has the personal tragedy with his family and his brother, and the brain exploded, then your heart exploded, and it's just like it is that we've got to make a full length documentary feature film just about Doublelift. Not only is he a North American Hall of Famer, but it is just such a roller coaster of a ride going
amazing
back
story.
Through the whole story.
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, like there's people who have had bigger successes in league, obviously with all the world championships and stuff like that, but I don't think there's anyone with a more impressive and insane story than Doublelift. Like I think, if anyone was ever going to make a documentary, like full-length feature film about someone, get an actor in there, not even documentary, a recreation, a dramatization, whatever you want to call it. Like, I would pick Doublelift easily. Like you're talking about, his career spans up until this point the entire history of league esports, so that's a great lens to view it through. His growth with the scene's growth and all those different things. And like you're saying, for him, it was never just about league. I mean, it's true.
I mean, league is his life.
Yeah. And that's true for most pro players. Everyone kind of drops everything to become a pro player. But for him, I think there's a lot higher stakes and there's a lot more going on than just pursuing a dream.
And how longstanding it is, right? When you think about, even when I think about esports as my adult life, esports is literally 100% of my adult life. I didn't go to university. It was in high school, I started doing pro gaming stuff and, I've been involved in esports my entire life. For Doublelift, that's true as well, but it's only been as a pro, right? Like his entire adult life is just pro gaming and League of Legends, one game. And I think that, of course it's going to be so intertwined with who you are and what you have done. And it's been this pretty incredible story. And something that I am personally going to miss with Doublelift is also just the interviews and stuff.
Yeah.
He's known for, the trash talk answers, the spicy answers, he would say it's the honest answer. And I always appreciate that because it can be hard to walk that line of confident and cocky and not just get roasted for it. A lot of players have tried it over the years and kind of gotten burned by the fans, maybe, dumped on when something goes bad. So a lot of players give much more PR answers, just safer to do. And Doublelift has never really gone that route. So I've always enjoyed, his kind of clips and interviews and stuff that we get from the LCS. You could always expect him to say what was on his mind. If he thought his team was trash, if he thought they were going to stomp him, whatever, he was going to tell you about it. And that's something that I think made for a lot of fun interviews and clips over the years.
Yeah, I think to that point about other people who have tried it, a lot of times when other people try and trash talk, it feels almost like a little like I'm playing up a part. But with Doublelift, it was like, that's just who he is. That was his identity. You're always wondering should you be saying this? Your foot's going to be in your mouth in a little bit. It didn't a lot of trash talk feels like for showmanship. And a lot of times for him, like you said, it just felt like that's who he was. And he did it, for his whole career. So it wasn't like necessarily this phase. I think it changed over time. I got a little bit more, a little less trash talky as his career went on. But he was such a refreshing personality in the scene that I don't think there's anyone comparable. You know, there's been a couple people in the scene who have had really unique personalities, and he was definitely one of them. That's, you're not just losing this history, you're not just losing this career, you're losing this voice in the scene.
And the thing about Doublelift's trash talk too, and where it comes from, is because he has such a deep history with League, and he put in his time as the underdog on CLG fighting up against TSM during the height of TSM's dominance. You build this up as the underdog, and then once an underdog overcomes and then you're on top, you just have so much confidence, you're just letting loose. And and that sort of confidence to also not be too dissuaded by fan sentiment and social media and all this stuff that is really hard to deal with for young pros, and anybody in the public eye, really. You really have to build this up to be able to to handle it and have that confidence and that level of showmanship. It's really a special thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's the one kind of like sad note to his story, I think, as far as his career goes, is that he never really had the international success. I do think, though, that despite what a lot of people have said, I think over the last couple of years, yes, there have been bad games, but internationally, he played way better than he did earlier in his career. And I do think he has stepped up. It's a shame that he never got out of groups. It's a shame they didn't have that international success. But I don't think that's something that should be like this huge mark against him. Because to me, one of the ways that like I always kind of judge pro players' careers, and it's something that I think is incredibly impressive, is just the longevity and the consistency. Because it's so hard to actually maintain that level of skill and that level of dominance for so long, to really truly be at the top of the region with all these new players coming for like 8-10 years, right? You know, it's something that not a lot of people ever are able to do. And it really does show that it's you are a multifaceted player. It's not that you can only play one way. It's not that you can only play one champion or one style. You've got to adapt over the years and be able to grow and change with the games, with the teams. And I think that's something that he was really able to do. There's just not a lot of people. It's like a handful of players really anywhere in the world that have been able to match that sort of longevity and dominance.
And the final thing I'll say is his peak was as high as any peak in North American pros had, to be fair. I mean, you can debate, is semifinals for C9 more impressive than the finals MSI appearance, finals, yeah. MSI finals that CLG had with 6A and Afro and Doublelift had, and like, you know, who they beat IG to get there, like all these different things. You can compare them, but at the very least, they're all in the same conversation for best achievement in North America. And yes, he's had more failures, but like you're saying about longevity, like just statistically, not everything's going to end in a success. It's more likely that you fail than you succeed. So of course, anyone with a storied career is going to have a lot of failures. At this point, how long has it been since Faker won world championship? He's had a couple failures now, not qualifying for, like, this happens to every great players that they have down points in their career.
So Uzi retired earlier. There have been multiple people within Uzi's camp, and even Uzi on streaming, have talked about the possibility of coming back. With Doublelift leaving, and I know, talking to him, he's like, very much like, okay, I'm retired now. And I know Azale has been like playing WoW with him and stuff. And
he's washed up. He's a gamer dad.
He's really fresh. He's fresh after retirement. So he's gonna be like, yeah, I'm totally retired. But it didn't take long to get Uzi back with his eyes on it, him being like, all right, I fixed my health issues, maybe I'll get back in there. Is there a world where we turn around and we like, all right, Doublelift, we got you a great support, speaks perfect English, and it's a super team, get back in there for an actual crazy like return arc, just to make the story even more crazy?
I mean, I think it's definitely possible. I talked to him a bit about retirement and stuff, and I just know from my experience, it's like, in talking to him, Worlds is like the big thing for him now, right? Because that's like the thing he didn't achieve. So right now, right after Worlds, it's the easiest time to be okay with your retirement.
Yep.
Because it's the furthest away. And that's how I felt when I was playing WoW at the end, was it was like, okay, at this point, all I care about is BlizzCon, right? And if something goes bad at BlizzCon and you lose, and something goes bad at Worlds and you lose, you're like, I have a whole friggin' year of grinding every day just have a chance to do this one thing that I want to do, right? So like, it's so daunting. And if that's all you care about at this point, I mean, he's won LCS so many times. He has done that, right? He's looking for something more. So I could see as the year progresses, that desire getting there, because it's going to be hard. It's really hard to sit on the sidelines as a spectator and watch other people have success and be like, I could be there. I could still be doing that. Like, you're going to get that itch. You know, if there was a time, I would think it wouldn't be in spring. I would think you might start getting that itch in summer, but then it's a question of, can you find the perfect roster to actually make you want to come back? Can you maintain your skills at the same level? Like, are you still going to be grinding every day to be worth, you know, building that super team around?
I will say, just think, I don't know what Kobe's about to say, but we do have a question about world's attainability. And I think it was a Twitter question. Maybe it was one of the anchor ones coming up, because we will be doing a bunch of questions this episode. So I don't want to speculate on, like, is it even a good goal? Because that is an interesting conversation, but I know we're going to have it later. The only thing I'd throw in there as well is that, like, it sounds like there has been some drama this offseason at TSM, and we don't have the whole story yet. Hopefully we do. I don't want to go down the rabbit hole. But it is one of those things that does make you wonder, you know, like, as you're saying, as time progresses, does that itch return? And is it just like a fresh wound with, you know, your friend retiring in Bjergsen and going 0-6 at Worlds and like all these compounding factors that lead to the decision to retire? And if he comes back.
Well, I actually also was, well, I was going to say that this conversation leads right into Sword Art. because you're talking about, you know, what supports could we get with them and super team building and stuff like that. I think we should move on to the next little piece of TSM info before we get to the questions. I know this is taking a long time, but we keep on having these big retirements. Just quickly on Sword Art, I do think it is a great pickup. I know the price tag is really big, and they did have stuff come up with the taxes. And so that's, you know, there was this big bump where TSM, you know, and a lot of Western companies are usually used to giving salaries in pre-tax numbers. And a lot of times, if you're doing business in Asia, you have to specify pre-tax or post-tax. It's very, very different. And so that's why there's such a big price tag on Sword Art. I do think it's a great pickup. I'm not going to go into like a money managing and like, oh, maybe, you know, overspend, underspend, that type of thing. But at the very least, I will tackle the topic I've seen come up where people are like, oh, it's just going to be TSM, like when they brought in Yellowstar or when they brought in Mythy again. They're trying to sign a shot calling support to fix the team's macro and shot calling, and it's going to be a bomb. I think that Sword Art is a very different story from both of the supports, and especially like the Yellowstar time, because Sword Art was just in World Finals, very clearly still has really strong mechanics, and already from the like small clips of his stream and stuff, you know, his English is great, and he's very, very focused on you know, on controlling macro, on trying to you know, help the team in that way. So I do think it's a good pickup. That's the last I'll say on this. You guys can chime in, and then we can move on to the questions.
No, I don't have too much to say. I mean, top five support in the world that you just brought over, you know, like that's almost always going to be a good move. I mean, there, like you said, there's the price tag component, which we're not exactly sure. Like, is this bankrupting TSM or ruining their ability to, you know, like that's a GMing question more than like a just player question. Because on the surface, yeah, Sword Art's incredible. I agree with your point about like he is a veteran, but it's not like it was with those other two players where their mechanics were not their folk, like not the big focus for them. Sword Art still has absolutely incredible mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It'll be interesting. I mean, I think I'm really interested to see how Lost is going to do with him as well. Right. Because the understanding was that Sword Art was going to come to play the spot lane with Doublelift. Right. And that was going to be kind of like why they were going so big on a support. And I do think there's going to be some pretty big, shoes to fill for Lost. You know, he's going to have, I think, a really good season for this to honestly kind of be worth it, right? If you spend $3 million for Sword Art to come over here for a year and you're losing lane, it's going to be tough. So excited to see how it does turn out. So we're going to do something a little bit different this episode. If you guys watched the last episode before we took a break for Thanksgiving, we were talking about doing kind of, you know, mailroom type thing where we take a bunch of your guys' questions. We always get so many more than we can answer throughout the year. And since there's so much to cover during the year, we wanted to do some kind of bonus off-season episodes that we wouldn't normally do and try to get through a lot of your questions. So that is what we are going to do now. We have compiled a whole bunch of them and we are going to start going through some of them. All right, this first one here is from, I think it was Zavi. We heard it as. I'm not actually sure. This is an anchor question, and he wants to know about the LCS's next great superstars.
Hey there, Mark, Kobe, and Azale. My name is Xavier from Montreal, and my question for you guys on the dive is, are the next great superstars of the LCS already playing in the league currently, or should we expect to see these superstars joining the league this year in 2021? Thank you.
I think some of column A, some column B. I think that we could have some people that you haven't seen before, you know, develop into those big superstars. I think that guys like FBI are already on track for that, right? I think that guys like Tactical are already on track for that. We have seen some of these players come in and look incredible. In the early stages of their career. And I do think that especially, you know, with so much more light being shined on them, with Doublelift being gone and Sneaky being gone and Bjergsen being gone, you know, we'll really be able to kind of get more attention on some of these players, and it'll be exciting to see them develop.
I think also depends what you mean by superstars joining the league in 2021. Like, are we counting Perks and Alfari and Sword Art and some of those guys? Or was the question more like up and coming people who will then become superstars versus like
superstars, right?
Right.
So like, so I would not that adopted not, ones, not Perks and Sword Art, because they're already superstars.
I mean, if you didn't do it in NA, then are you really a superstar? Azale, Hollywood is here, so.
I'd say that there's also players, like you're saying, who could be on the come up, you know, and not necessarily in this year even.
There better be, Mark.
I mean,
you better hope there are some goddamn stars on the rise coming in.
We need them. I think, you know, like, there's some of those players who are getting their first shot now, and I know we'll talk about the turnover rate this year, and some of those guys will probably need some time to develop, and I'm looking forward to some of their personalities. Like, Niles is someone who I don't expect to dominate on Golden Guardians this year, but he's a really funny guy, and I've always enjoyed watching his interviews and stuff, and he's very personable in the collegiate scene, so, like, I hope he turns out to be really good, so then we can get some, you know, louder, brasher personalities in the scene. What would he like?
It was just like the delivery of, like, you know, he might not be the next superstar, but he's really funny.
I'm saying this year, I don't think he'll, like, Golden Guardians is clearly a development team.
No, it was funny because I was
talking
to Tactical and, like, Papa Smithy and some people yesterday, and they were also specifically mentioning, like, his personality and how funny he is. So I just like that combination. But I have to reiterate, you better hope there's some more freaking superstars on the way that are still to join. Like guys like General Sniper, he's too young to even get signed as a streamer for a team right now. And that is North American talent as well. So I would really, really hope that there is, you know, column A and column B, because everybody should be super excited for Tactical and Spica. Having performed at Worlds is a really big thing to me, and Spica especially going into probably the most dangerous job of League of Legends, the TSM jungle position, and still showing two of the most important things for junglers, confidence and innovation, is really big for me. Then obviously I think Tactical dominating goes for you guys, just typing up a storm. Tactical's performance at Worlds goes a long way, and him having the perfect mentor in Core JJ is definitely setting him up for success as well.
All right, next one here, this one comes from VU about lane assignments.
Hey guys, my question is, do you ever think that the lane assignments is something that will ever be experimented with in League? It seems like this is one of the oldest aspects of League, yet it is one of the things that is the least experimented with. Teams for the past 10 years have really just been handshaking that there will be one mid, one top, one jungle, and two bot. Could there ever be a team that one day pulls out a cheese strat with a Yumi attached to a mid laner, for example? And I know that there was technically the lane swap meta, but I'd say that's just a mirror of the current lane assignment and not really an innovation. Thanks.
I think changes like that are really good when they are options for strategy. And it's really hard to balance the game to have options like that that don't come over and dominate. Because you would also say another iteration of this is funneling. And I think we can all agree that funneling is booty. Everybody hates funneling. All my homies hate funneling. Nobody wants to see that shit. Only the boosters like funneling. Okay. So you have to be, it's like, it's such a dangerous thing, to mess with. And it's really hard to balance, you know, changes in, assignments like that. I do like when I see in a meta right now where there are even obstacles for it, we still see, even with an extra 5 minute of damage reduction on top and mid, we still see sometimes like, oh my God, you know, the Tristana randomly, you know, they have a different lane for top and bottom versus a specific champion where they actually try and make that trade anyway and go for a lane swap. If you see it rarely like that sprinkled in, I do like that. And I will also say that lane swaps were experimented a lot at the very beginning. And since Riot made changes to actually remove some of those options and make it a bit more stricter, I don't see that being reversed.
People do lane swaps sometimes, and I also say that I think you as a viewer don't see the amount of experimenting that people do. I think the idea that people are just handshaking this stuff is wrong. People do actually do a lot of experiments, especially at new seasons. Like when Rift Herald was first introduced, and I was still with the team, they were like, I think I was still with the team, maybe I wasn't, but there was a lot of practice about like, hey, what if we put our bot lane top? Is Rift Herald the more important objective to control early on than, you know, the dragon? And so like whenever, sorry, people do these experiments, and people aren't handshaking like, oh, we just assume this is the best way to play. It's the best way to play. Generally speaking, there are really niche situations you can get into that you can do these different strategies that Kobe's talking about, but it's not just a handshake that people don't experiment. They do the experimenting and they keep landing on this because it's the optimal way to play. The same way it's not optimal to put five centers in basketball and play with a team of seven footers, even if you can theorycraft a situation where you're like, we'll get every rebound. You know, it's like actually not the right way to play.
But the basketball one is kind of funny because basketball has evolved from, you know, a game that was played somewhat heavily around big men in the post to shooting now, right? Now, like, everyone shoots threes, right? And even like football has evolved in a way, yeah, where people talk about like going for 2-point conversions. And so like games can evolve even they within do. The same restrictions. So there is possibility for that. But I do think that partially because Riot, you know, generally wants to have this more standard meta, like there are changes, like Kobe said, that discourage these other sort of things. So I do think it might require metagame changes, like as far as like, you know, meta systems changes on Riot's end, because there's a reason that you don't necessarily put the Yumi mid with your mid laner, because most mid laners are champions that are very reliant on experience, right? So it's solo lane experience. It's the same reason that most of those champions don't, you know, function as effectively in the bot lane. There are exceptions though, and would be cool to see if we can get some innovation in the future. Definitely do enjoy watching that myself. Next question here comes from Luke Spitzley. Has rookie investment gone too far?
Hey guys, love the show and hope to hear more from you soon. My question is about rookie investment in LCS and whether or not that has gone overboard. Majority of C9 Academy will be making the jump to LCS, and other even less proven talents will be starting when competent veterans like Hanser and Cody Sun aren't playing. Let me know your thoughts.
Right off the bat, I was thinking, even with the just a little blurb at the beginning where you're like, has rookie investment gone too far? Just like if that's the title of an article or something to be like the
that's
the
a clickbait. That's like, getting you
no!
interesting.
No one has. I do see where you're going with this, and I think there is a possibility of because all the GMs right now, you know, are under a lot of pressure, obviously. You know, if you're running the team from the money perspective, everybody's like, why can't you find the next tactical? Or, hey, you had the chance at this as well. You know, where's my value from? You know, that is always going to be a high priority. And I do see some overcorrection, you know, with fans as well, where they're like, oh, you know, this player is now 26, get him out, too old, you know, stuff like that. Where people draw hard lines. I don't think it has gone overboard yet, but I can see the areas where it would, where people are just so enamored and with the idea of like finding the next big star, and they throw away you know, someone who still has a lot of drive and is looking to improve and stuff like that.
I think that it's also like a lot of this is just on the team side, right? As far as I think that team's perspective on how to build their roster has changed. I think that, you know, with the huge spend that is happening at the top of the league, you know, when you look at TSM and C9 and Liquid, not every team is going to be able to match that. And I think teams' opinions on what success is going to look like and what they should be going for has changed as well, right? So a team like Golden Guardians, who's losing a lot of their players, instead of just picking up veterans and trying to get sixth place or whatever, is more willing to have a rebuild year now. I do think that is a good thing for the league. And I do think that that can help foster more talent coming forward in the future. But not every team is just going to go for the highest possible position in this next split every time, right? Teams are going to be looking to build further down the road. Some teams might be looking 1 year down the road. Some might be looking 2 years down the road. And I think that the goals are going to change. And I think that's okay. I think that's a good thing. As far as like the Haunter and Cody Sun stuff specifically, again, I think that's more of like a specific GM in question. Like, are people evaluating players correctly? You know, should some of these players be in a different place? It's hard to say. Because even Solo that I've heard doesn't have a spot, right? And that seems pretty crazy after his performance. Also, the age thing, I completely agree with Kobe. Like, it does feel like sometimes people go too far the other way, where it's like, oh, this player's too old. Like, get rid of him. He's washed up. Because I've even heard that about Grig a fair bit. And Grig is, what, 21?
He changed his name.
He's Armao or yeah. Armeo. Yeah. His is Armeo name. Or Armao?
I don't know.
but... You know, like that one to me was like, it was funny because I watched the intro video, like Spawn did, the TL Academy, you know, roster announcement. And he's like, he's only 21. I was like, damn, like everyone's saying, you know, like
he's washed.
He's at his chance. The man's 21.
If you perform poorly in some TSM games, then you're going to get that death note. Yeah.
I'll say that, like, I could see this being an overcorrection year a little bit, but I also think that we are overdue for one in a sense where, you know, for too long there hadn't been enough opportunity given to rookies. And what I understand from Hunter on Hotline League talking about this in depth quite a bit about how COVID has hurt a lot of the teams that have NBA backing investment and budgeting for future for all their you know, teams and stuff has been cut a little bit. And so for some of these teams that can't go out and sign three big name free agents, you know, you're not going to win the championship that year. You're not going to go to Worlds probably. So what's your plan? Just sign a bunch of the best available talent left and go for seventh or sixth? You know, I think a lot of these teams are being smarter now and realizing, no, we shouldn't do that. I should go try and find pieces that will eventually develop and that I can build around in the future. So I have a couple players that I've developed and are good, and then I can sign players to fill in the gaps. And I think it's much better. Yeah, I think it's much better to do that. And he talked about the stratification of league being more split up now, as like you're talking about these big boys, TL, TSM, C9 are blowing the bank for this. And you're going, okay, I can't compete with that. So I'm gonna have a different strategy. And I think that's really healthy. And a number of teams are doing it this year, maybe more than really should be because of COVID, you could maybe say. But overall, I think it's a really good thing for the league.
I was going to say, I think it should actually go beyond just the teams that are forced into it, because
right.
Golden Guardians have no choice, right? You don't have money. So it's not like they're like, you know what? Let's go with this crazy plan, rebuilding.
Well, I think it is, to be fair. I think a year or two ago, that would have been a team of the cheapest veterans you could get. And we've seen that. We've seen that happen in the LCS how many times?
Anyways, my point, I don't agree. I don't think so. I think that they are forced into
what's,
this.
What's the last all rookie team in the LCS?
There hasn't been one. There's been no all rookie team.
Well, that's what I mean. Like team 2K, even majority rookie, even no, three rookies.
I don't think there has ever been a team that has had their funding pulled like Golden Guardians has. Just talking to people behind the scenes. And my point is, I think it should go beyond that, because there are teams, and we should talk about the middle ones, like Evil Geniuses, that clearly do have a lot of extra money to spend, and they haven't been able to get the most optimal big stars to pull in. Like they've got the money to spend. So I feel like there is actually a need for searching out and finding still and building this new talent, because there is clearly extra money and extra, teams willing to pay for top dollar for proven stuff, but there is just not enough supply here. So we need to create more. Anyways, we'll get into that stuff later with roster
talk. I'm sure we will. Yeah.
All right. Got another question here. This one comes from Shamil Ahmad. I probably brutalized that name. I apologize. Where will the LCS stand next year without the names?
Hi, Azel. Hi, Mark. And hi, Kobe. Given that so many big names of the LCS have retired this year, I think that next year will be a very big year to see where the LCS stands internationally. As Doublelift said in his recent stream, he believes the gap is only growing bigger between North America and the other major regions, and that North America will never win Worlds. He even said that Core JJ agreed with this opinion of his. What do you guys think? Also, cat for Kobe.
Still alive.
I love how much Travis hates that. That's what keeps it going in my heart.
I love how much he hates it.
I don't deal with any of the negatives of it, though. I just like have this like joy in my heart knowing that Travis hates it every time he sees it. So that just like prompts me to want to say cat for Kobe all the time. Yeah.
I mean, so this is
whatever makes you say it more.
This is an interesting question because there's two elements, like struggling without the big names in a competitive sense and in a like engagement sense, or, you know, fan viewership kind of thing. And it sounds like he's talking more about the competitive angle.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of the gap growing is a tough one for me to agree with. Holistically, I think in the short term, yeah, the gap looks like it's grown. This is 2 years in a row now, no teams out of groups. But just before that, we had a team at semifinals and a team that made finals of MSI in back-to-back tournaments. So I think the gap is, you know, like it's like a canyon or a coastline. You know, it's going to narrow and wide and then narrow and wide at different points. And so, yeah, probably has grown in the past 2 years. I think it can get narrowed again with Perks coming in, some of the other great players, and hopefully, like we're talking about, these newer rookies stepping up and having turnover of new talent, and hopefully in a year or two, even next year, if C9's incredible, then the gap has been closed again. And I think, will NA ever win Worlds is a different question, and it's harder to say. But, you know, depending on how long League is alive, like, yeah, sure. Statistically, every year that League goes on, you know, it's another chance. It's another chance. And it's another chance. And eventually it'll break the way.
I believe I also saw another comment from Core JJ when he was talking about, in-houses and all this types of stuff, where he does see the future of the region needing to build up a lot of the new players and showcase a lot of them too, is why he's putting so much effort into this. And also recognizing that there needs to be space made, for kind of an updraft. So, how we're going to deal with losing those big names is creating new ones. And everybody loves to see whoever is at the peak of their craft, right? You always love to see, whoever is the best at anything. Like, that's why there are all these random shows on Netflix, like who's the best sword maker now? Who's the best glass blower now? all these types of competition. I'm like, hey, I'll turn into that. Yeah. I don't care. It's the best at anything. I want to see what the best at any specific craft is. We need to keep doing that and building up the new ones for a League. I'll watch that. You know, we got is Tactical going to be the next one? Is it some unknown youngster coming in? Those are the types of things we got to go for.
That's sports, right? New stars rise up all the time. And I think that we're going to continue to see that in the LCS. I'm actually really excited about this new season because of that, because I want to see who is going to step up and become, those next big stars in the region. All right, the next question here comes from Kevin Van Egdom, and it's a question on the League of Legends Hall of Fame.
Hey, guys. I just wanted to quick ask about your thoughts on a Hall of Fame for League, and just kind of thoughts about how that would best work, whether that's something that could be viable in the future that look like an international Hall of Fame. Would it be a regionally based thing? Just think it'd be really cool, especially with some of the timings of our greats kind of leaving the scene now. So thanks.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. we've talked about this a lot in the past, you know, even just like within the LCS team and stuff. We talked about this, you know, the casters and producers and everything. I think it would be really cool. I personally think it makes more sense to just have, like, you know, each region has their own, you know, Hall of Fame type thing. You know, maybe there's some sort of global thing, but then the criteria becomes much more complex. There are, you know, who is voting on this? Is it just purely based off international success? Is it significant contributions to your region? Like, how are you doing it? And that varies so differently, you know, for every region. You know, some of the minor regions, would they even have players in it? So to me, it's like, it just makes sense to have your own. And I do think that at this point we have, you know, a lot of players and a lot of people that have contributed significantly to the sport and to the league. And it would be cool to see them recognized. And I think that, you know, some of the players, you know, that retired this year, right? You know, very clearly guys like Doublelift and Bjergsen should be in there. That's no brainers. Those are, you know, like first ballot, you know, you're in the Hall of Fame. I think it would be cool. I would love to see that, you know, especially like, I would think it would be cool to even just like visit something like that, you know, if it was like an actual physical place that you could see, you know, and see like memorabilia or like their best highlight plays and like this sort of thing. I think that would be super hype to like go to LCS and there's like, you know, Hall of Fame thing that you can go in and kind of stroll through memory lane of some of the coolest plays and coolest things.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot. And I think to the college point, it's a good time to do it. You know, 10-year anniversary of kind of league esports and league as a whole with L10 or whatever, League 10, whatever it was called. And like you said, a bunch of big names leaving. I think it's definitely hopefully time to start exploring some of this stuff.
All right, the next one here comes from Mitchell Fairchild. He wants to know about free agents with successful resumes.
Hi, Kobe, Mark, and Azale. Hope you're having a relaxing offseason. When considering the value of a free agent, there's a lot of stock put into their past successes, such as domestic titles or successful Worlds performances. In your opinion, how much value should you place on a player's resume, and at what point should it start being outweighed by their current form? Shout out to Honda. Thanks for helping this show happen.
Let's go. Nice one.
Plugs for us.
Ayo.
I think that it should current form should immediately outweigh any past performances like that, especially since you're mentioning titles won, because it's so much of a team game, and you obviously have to go in and look at this title series and see how that person even performed within that individual title series. So, you know, every GM, every coaching staff, scouting staff get into a much more granular looking at the games. Obviously, they don't just look at, you know, gold medals or you know, any type of medals or titles. But especially even just theoretically, your current form should be number one, you know, priority.
Yeah, a lot of competitive things are what have you done for me lately kind of endeavors and league should 100% be that way. I don't care you won Worlds 2 years ago. What are you doing now?
I do care a little bit.
I mean, maybe for brand value and to be able to say that. But
so
you know,
the one thing I would say is because we always mention this like nebulous thing of you know, playing in those high pressure situations or just even experiencing Worlds, experiencing the meta that goes on, the time crunch, the scrims that evolve and your practice partners get whittled down and, you know, meta changes very quickly and you have to adapt. Those types of things, experiencing it can be a bonus, but not a requirement, because we've also seen, you know, obviously so many rookies succeed. So that's why I would be very nuanced with it and be like, okay, this is a bonus, but it's not a requirement.
Yeah. And I do think one valuable piece of those past successes is that, you know, kind of like what good looks like, right? You know what it can look like to actually, when everything comes together and to win a world championship, you know, what kind of work is required, what kind of ways they improved and those types of things that can be really beneficial to a team. But of course, if the player is not playing well, then they would be better served to be a coach, right? In that case, right? You know, use that knowledge in a different way. All right. We have some Twitter questions here now. This one, Kobe, what you got? Cole WN tweets us and wants to know what's the most fun build you found with preseason items. He says his AP volley.
I played an AP volley bear on stream actually when I had my like very rare stream come out. I thought it was super fun. But I also was not very tanky. I think AP volley bear might be better for top lane.
where you have more levels and you have more income. Anytime you do have something that is, it's kind of a similar theory to like super hard carries from other games like Dota, where you do have Omnivamp plus you have this big shield that you're like using offense to get to generate defense. And if you pop off in the jungle, you can definitely do that, but it might be better served from top lane with, you know, more power budget. For me personally, my most fun thing right now is the Prowler's Claw. I don't know if I talked about this last time, but it gives so much lethality and it gives a long distance jump that is so much better than the Stride Breaker, which is like this baby hop that actually feels like you lagged a little bit or something.
You spun in a circle.
Exactly. And the Prowler's Claw, I've actually dodged a lot of skill shots just running up to people and then not like knowing I have it, and they shoot a skill shot out and I dash through them. So I've like dodged ultimates and stuff. Obviously it works really well with things like Rek'Sai, where you have a tunnel. But one of your biggest problems for Rek'Sai is you usually have to flash to, you know, to close the rest of the distance or something on people. But having Prowler's Claw, another gap closer, that's also lethality, just turns you into a crazy person in the jungle, always looking for the kills. One for ones are a no brainer. I feel like everybody will become Ning when they have a Prowler's Claw of Rek'Sai, just going in looking for that kill onto the carry. Doesn't matter if I die for it. So I definitely have a lot of fun with stuff like that. If you're wanting to win though, I would say the health generation from the Gore Drinker for Kane and Olaf right now, go Gore Drinker on those suckers. And, especially if your opponents don't build executioners quickly, yeah, it's going to be fun.
I talked about some of the builds that I think are OP already and tweeted about them. But if I'm talking about what I think is just straight up fun, So I was playing some set support with like the new Richest Glory item with what is it called? Like
Turbo Chem Tank.
With chem that spirit. And Dead Man's and Swifties and just sprinting around at 1,000 miles an hour. It's basically, it just feels like the old support set build with the Dead Man's Rush, but on steroids. A lot of move speed stuff I just think is so fun for similar reasons that like Prowler's Claw is fun. I also was trying to mess around a little bit with Prowler's Claw, Lee Sin, after I saw some clips. You can do some really cool stuff with that, but I'm a horrible Lee Sin, so it definitely was not looking nice when I was messing around with it.
Are you one of the ones that like puts down the ward, looks at it, then ward hops to it?
No, I don't even try. I'm one of the ones that only kick flashes. Because I can do that every time. The ward hop, I'm like, I'm ward hopping to get on top of you, and then I'm kick flashing you.
I'm going to go ahead and pull a different Twitter question.
Get it.
Some old gamer dude at Old Man Sparky.
Oh, that's me.
That's all of us, I think. He said, part of the appeal for me to watch esports was how different it was. As esports continues to become mainstream and professionally produced, does the professionalism actually detract from some of the appeal it had as it leaves its nerd geek roots?
I mean, that's completely subjective, right? I think that there's a difference between like more casual and relaxed and fun and just like trash production, right? And I think that some things do manage like to keep the charm and still be produced really well. I think a lot of old esports was just produced so badly. Like when I think back to, you know, 10 years ago watching esports tournaments, one of the things that really attracted me to League of Legends, and this is just sounds funny now because it's almost just a given, was that they had a countdown clock on commercials, and it actually came down when the countdown clock ended. Mm-hmm. It actually the game came back and it started.
You're not waiting for an hour for a next IEM game?
Let's not talk about World Season 2, okay? Let's not talk about that.
I mean, of course there are exceptions. Yeah, yeah. Yes, but that was it wasn't the exception in other games. It was the rule. Like on average, you are waiting like oftentimes 30 plus minutes between every game because of technical delays, because of issues, because the refs couldn't wrangle setting players up. Because yeah, they had to set up and you know, they didn't have their own PC, so you'd get on the PC after someone else played, you had to redo all the settings. It was just a mess. And like so to me, when I think of like the old esports and now it's too professional, I think of that and I'm like, well, I actually didn't like watching that. Usually I just tuned out when there was an hour in between a game. So to me, hopefully you can walk the fine line, right? Of like having fun and joking around and having some goofy stuff. But like if I'm going to watch it, if I'm going to spend my time watching it, I want it to start on time and I want it to run smoothly.
Yeah, I think technical improvements and running and like all the things that go into a good production are just like straight clear upgrades that everyone would want. I don't think anyone would ever want that kind of stuff. And there is unfortunately a bit of a push and pull, because to iron out a lot of those problems, a lot of things become more pre-produced in a sense. You have schedules and timelines and all these things that make it work because that's how it works well. But then sometimes you get rigid and you get the kind of forced feeling in some of this stuff. And I do think that it, even beyond esports, just even in gaming and shows and stuff, you see things that start out like bedroom, but really well done, you know, and then they get sponsors and there's more of a business behind it. And then suddenly it like its soul almost just goes away. And like now this person who was previously talking intimately into a webcam is now like on a very big set on a couch. And it just feels like hollow and cold from the warmth that it had before. And I do think that's one of the things that can happen as you improve, is sometimes you go beyond just these technical improvements that we're talking about and you start removing some of the charm to the question's point that I definitely see. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I think people should be aware of, because to your point about what people enjoy, it's always going to be different, but you still have a core demographic. And I think the core demographic of people who play video games and watch esports are way more down with like people shooting the shit on a couch and just being idiots. You know, like I think that's an appeal to a lot of them, is that you get this look. They're like, hey, there's Kobe's bedroom, you know, and it's not always this super produced cold set kind of thing.
I think there's also can be room for both, right? Yeah. And I think that a mix can be nice. But if any of you ever watched Home Story Cup, they had it for Hearthstone and stuff.
Yeah, too, I watched the Hearthstone ones.
But it started in StarCraft. And I think that was a good example of like charming, janky esports, you know, where it's like, if you've never watched it in StarCraft, they would literally have like a camera on the players playing poker. They'd all go to this apartment basically, that this guy would set up in Germany, and they'd play tournament games, but then you'd finish your game and you'd just go sit on the couch and you'd cast the next game. And so they had players, you know, funneling through and lots of personality, and it was like still produced pretty darn well. And I think that was a good example of like, you know, the charm of esports without sacrificing the other side. So I think that you can find elegant solutions. And I think that sometimes one thing fits and sometimes the other thing fits. It's also good to remember that oftentimes it's like, for esports to continue and to be successful, you need sponsors, and sponsors want a certain look and want a certain thing that works with their brand. A lot of big sponsors like the BMWs and the whatever are going to want a professional look. They don't want, you know, the janky bedroom cast or whatever. They want it to look a certain way because they are a luxury brand. They are, you know, a big brand, and that's something that you have to kind of work with.
Yeah. My take on this one is that variety is really important for me. If every broadcast is the, we're scuffed broadcast, or, you know, like T1 series is a really good example. When it comes around, I'm super excited to see what kind of, you know, stuff he pulls out. It's like one man show with all this like
the commercials,
you know,
yeah,
messed up commercials and, you know, green screens and stuff like that. If that was on every week, I don't think that it would keep its appeal and charm, you know, it might last a while, but like if you have that repeat all the time, you know, I don't know if people really want to have scuffed broadcast all the time. So I think variety is the way to go with it, because again, we don't want to lose that part either. I genuinely super enjoy those types of things when they pop up. Part of it is because it's more unique and rare now.
All right, got a one here from Brent Pointner. And this says, with both Bjerg and Reignover becoming head coaches, this is one of the first times we are seeing ex-pros become coaches in the LCS. How do you feel they might do compared to the typical analysts who become coaches? Do you think we'll see an increase in trend of pro to coach?
I don't think we'll see an increase, because I think when the scene is new, that's the best time to be like, hey, guy who played professionally and understands player mindset, why don't you become a coach? And I think as you go on and coaching infrastructure improves and there's more of a ladder to climb, so to speak, between someone who can just demonstrate their value as just an analyst who's offsite, then maybe to onsite, then maybe to assistant coach, like those kinds of things, you know, scale up, hopefully. And I think there's still always going to be value for player or a player to a coach transition. And so, you know, people like Bjerg and Rainover, it just makes sense a lot of the time to be like, hey, you were really smart about the game. You're a great player and you still are obviously very interested in the scene and you don't want to become just a streamer or something, you know, like this is probably the obvious career advancement. And they're probably going to be pretty good at it, at least because they were smart and they have what seemed to be good mindsets and personalities for working with other people.
So I would also say that maybe people are not aware that the majority of coaches were already players. Lustboy was a player. Loco Doco was a player. Song was a player. Kane was a player. ThinkCard was a player. Just because we are old and we were players a long, long time ago, you know, a lot of coaches were professional players at one.
I mean, even Jat, you're right. Like,
Jat was a pro player.
Golden Blue, Freeze. There's most of them.
It's actually, yeah, probably more the exception that you have.
It's for sure more than the exception.
So, probably still continue to see more. All right. We got this one from Jack Rossoff. He says, do you think teams like Golden Guardians, who decided to sign mostly rookies, can compete against teams like Cloud9, TL, and TSM? How will rookie and amateur careers be affected by throwing them into the fire against Perks, Sword Art, and other world's quality players?
I think we've seen this before, you know, players who get thrust into the spotlight before they're ready, or maybe there's not enough of a support system around them, and it hurts their confidence. It hurts the public's perception of said player, which can feed into that as well, just based off Reddit comments and tweets and stuff like that. So I do think that there is a semi-legitimate concern to worry about something like this, but I think it's hopefully something that teams and players and fans even get more aware of. Is like, this player is not expected to go up against Perks and beat him. You know, like, the expectation is that he will show something good and, you know, and can actually level up over time, and you give them breathing room to make these kinds of mistakes that they're gonna make as a newer player going up against a world's finalist. You know, like, and be prepared for those kinds of things, and, you know, organizations presenting their players not in like, this team's going to worlds, but like, hey, this is a really young guy that we believe in that has a lot of room to grow, and this kind of stuff, and telling that story, which hasn't been told. That, like, the amount of times that teams have leaned into the narrative that, like, we don't care about worlds is like close to zero. Teams rarely embrace that idea that we're a development team, and I think, you know, saying that actually endears fans to you and doesn't push them off. And I think teams need to do that with the young players.
Yeah, I mean, Golden Guardians, Hunter put out the video talking about, hey, we don't have the funding that we thought we had before. So, you know, yes, we do get a decision, but our decision is, you know, what to do with a lot less money. And, you know, most established players are going to be negotiating for, you know, much, you know, or at least a little bit higher deals than these unknown, very, very, very green players, or very, very unsuccessful players. And you do have to have those realistic expectations. Honestly, you're asking straight up, how are they going to do against them? I think Golden Guardians are going to get smashed. So yeah. That's what I'm expecting. That is going to be the intro for a lot of these games, is it's important to set the table. Hey, these guys are probably going to get smashed. They are newer players. They are not as good players. The team has a lot less money. Then if they overcome, and if they, you know, do have this growth and they improve by playing against this super strong competition. And when I'm playing a new game, I want to set it on high difficulty. I want to play against players that are better than me at this game so that I can learn from that. I can get better. You know, that makes the comeback story or the underdog story pay off. Like, that's what it's all about. You have to set it honestly first to be able to have the payoff at the end.
The glass half full side of rookies versus vets, I would say, is like, look at the LEC in summer. The top two teams in the regular season were Rogue and Mad Lions, right? And halfway through the split, it was like, are Fnatic and G2 even going to make playoffs? You know, they were down around, I don't know what it was, fifth to seventh-ish area. Mm-hmm. Of course, they ended up, you know, being the best teams anyway. But, you know, you can have young teams compete and you can have young teams succeed. I don't know if it's going to be this Golden Guardians team, but, you know, I am hopeful that we will see, as more and more attention is being paid to rookies, that more of these good players are getting brought up and we start to find more consistently good rookies. Because we have come to expect in NA that rookie means, you know, not good. Almost like that's almost how it's instilled in you. But we do see teams with like no Worlds experience from other regions go to Worlds and slam, right? We see these teams with players that are brand new, you know, exploding onto the scene and having incredible success. So I'm hopeful that we can start to build towards that in North America as well.
Another question here that's kind of along this line is from Kirby at Kirby99 with a one for the I and Kirby. With the moving of the entire roster for what we can assume is big money and the acquisition of a very promising future looking roster, would you say that FlyQuest won the offseason? And if not, who else is in contention from EU? They already missed Perks. And I mean, I don't think we need to power rank them, but at least what are your guys' thoughts on the FlyQuest moves?
I would not say that they won the offseason. And if we are getting into analyzing, you know, efficiency and money and who has money, who does not have money, what they did with this money, you know, I would like to watch that behind the scenes, you know, little documentary or whatever, but we don't have that information. I have, you know, some bits and pieces of what people have said about things that went on. But I don't nearly have, you know, full enough info to be like, yeah, you know, this was actually a big brain move, because I've had so many times where, you know, I'll meet up with someone later and ask them, oh, so at the beginning of the season, you know, X thing happened, this signing, like you guys killed it. And they're like, that is not what we wanted at all. We didn't even think that was going to work, or, you know, this big thing blew up. And there's so much, you know, speculation that goes into it. That all being said, I do think FlyQuest did a good job in the offseason. I like the like little Cloud9 package that they got with Palafox. All right, cat time. Mark, get him back up here. That was adorable.
Oh, I didn't see him. What are you doing, buddy?
He climbed up on your chair.
That was adorable.
Oh.
I do think FlyQuest did a really good job with it, losing all of these players, because very clearly FlyQuest had been on an upswell, building and building with these players, getting synergy, improving across the board, and it was, you know, is coming to a peak, so much so that, yeah, it is assumed a lot of the players, you know, getting big offers and getting pulled apart and bought out there, especially like PoE. But I'm incredibly excited to see Jose Diodo, Palafox, Christian. I play flex queue with him a lot. I'm super excited to see what he can do on the stage. Don't mess this up, Christian. So I'm definitely going to be hyped for FlyQuest games.
I'm really excited right now. I think FlyQuest does have that little scary thing though, where it's like, this is a really exciting roster, and if it just goes out there and blows up and lays an egg, you know, it is a lot of young guys still, but there's licorice on the roster and some of this stuff where it's like, oh, I think some fans might be like, oh, I wish he was on a winning team or like a less developmental or
make it a winning team then.
I know. I mean, I'm hoping. Yeah. I believe that it can happen, but like Golden All Guardians. Right.
Now it's just bullying. Mark's
Zale called him over.
Why, buddy? He doesn't want to stay up here.
He's freaking out.
Stitch.
Let me down.
But yeah, I think FlyQuest having a little bit like a potential superstar on their team already puts a little bit extra pressure on them to be better now than a Golden Guardians is potentially facing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It'll be interesting. I think there's just got to be different expectations, like Kobe was setting. A lot of his expectation setting the table for like what a team should do, what success looks like for your team, and then judging your success based off did you over or underperform, you know, on those expectations, right? And I think that's something that we'll have to do for LCS, and that's something all these teams will have to do for LCS.
And I just want to add one more, because at the very end of the question, they say from EU already missed Perks, and they also said, okay, if FlyQuest didn't win it, then what team is in contention? I'm putting Cloud9 up there for stealing Perks, so there you go.
Just want to hear it.
Give you a little extra smile.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this week's episode of The Dive. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you, Honda, so much for making this possible. This is going to be our last episode of 2020. We will be back in January 2021. It's going to be a good year. fingers crossed, let's hope. And I just want to say thank you guys, everyone, for sending in all these questions. Hopefully you got some of yours answered. Remember, you can continue to send them in on anchor.fm, search The Dive. You can hashtag The Dive LOL on Twitter, send them in there. We appreciate you guys tuning in every week and sending us questions and hanging out with us and chatting leagues. So we will
Happy
see
holidays.
You next year.
Bye.